Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, I do have some more comments today. They're two short ones. This is, hello, Dennis. I just listened to number 185 on the Church of Global Warming. I would recommend two YouTube videos. The one is Why Renewables Can't Save the Planet, and I guess it's by Michael Schellenberger. And I don't know, it says TEDx Danubia. So I don't know if that's a TED Talk program or what that is. But anyway, obviously Carlos, who sent this in, does. And he says there's another film. It says And Thorium Can Give Humanity Clean Pollution, Free Energy. And that's by Kirk. And he says, sincerely, Carlos. And so I do think that's interesting. In that program, we talked about Gaia, the goddess of the earth. And in our next issue of the Philadelphia Trumpet magazine, Mr. Andrew Miller has a little commentary about Earth Day and how it's worshiping Gaia. And so I thought, well, at least I was ahead of the game for a while. So, but anyway, you might want to follow up and read that when you get into the Trumpet. I think it's going to be the August issue. So here's another one. This is a really short one. It says, Dear JBL, I regret that you will be ending your series on Charles Krauthammer's essays. That was the end. That's it. So I'm really glad to hear that somebody regrets that. But we're going to be finishing up here pretty quick with the series. But I may pepper some essays in through the other series as we go through that. So anyway, as I said, the last couple of programs, we are nearing the completion of our tribute to Charles Krauthammer series. Now, for today's podcast, I do want to talk about an essay found in Chapter 14 of Things That Matter. Now, this chapter is titled The Age of Holy Terror. I don't know if I would have used the word holy, but it's still the Age of Terror. And the essay is found on page 285, and it is titled September 11th, 2001. Now, to help me discuss this essay, back in the studio with me today is my friend Grant Turgeon. So thanks. Welcome, Grant.
Thanks for having me. It's great.
Yeah, well, thanks for taking the time to be with me on JBL. And so we had so much fun the last couple of times, I thought we ought to get back together. So anyway, I thought what we ought to do is just open up this essay. I'll read the first quote, and then we can launch into our discussion. I do have a few things I'd like to say about the technique he uses here, but we'll let me read this first. So this would be at the very top of page 285. It says, "This is not crime. This is war. One of the reasons there are terrorists out there capable and audacious enough to carry out the deadliest attack on the United States in its history is that while they have declared war on us, we have in the past responded, with the exception of a few useless cruise missile attacks on empty tents in the desert, by issuing subpoenas." No, I like that quote. I'm chuckling because I just love his technique. But one thing I think is interesting, Grant, that there's no quip in this essay. You know, like the almost all the other essays have their little quips at the beginning. And to me, that kind of leaves me, there's no doubt in my mind that Charles Krauthammer was intensely serious about this essay. And he was very disturbed at the U.S.'s weak response to the crisis.
That's exactly what struck me about this, too. The fact that there's no quip. The fact that this was written the very day after the terrorist attack.
Right.
So it's pretty palpable reading this that he is angry. From what he saw from less than 2 days' worth of U.S. officials speaking about the attack, he was already worked up and he already knew that their approach to fighting terrorism would be all wrong.
Yeah, I think it's again, I've just never ceased to be amazed at these essays. And really, I have to be honest, I've learned so much from just reading this book. I mean, there's been a lot of background study I've had to do as well, but he really was angry. But I think if you would get on all the other commentators out there at the same time, I don't think they would have been as angry as he is.
Very true. Was. It's also just fascinating here the way he distinguishes between criminals and a foreign enemy, and the way the differences in the ways that you have to deal with them. I guess I hadn't really thought a whole lot about that before, but it does seem like the way that we deal with criminals, we have to sort of presume they're innocent
until they're proven guilty,
right. Which means usually when you're apprehending them, you want to make sure that you don't kill them right away. But whenever it's a foreign enemy, you identify the enemy and there's no time for a trial. You just have to wipe them out.
Right, right. You know, I remember this day so well. I mean, when I think I mentioned this to you before, all the audience out there, is that whenever I invite a guest and I let them choose the essays, so Grant chose this essay, and I'm really glad you did. Now I get to talk about my story at 2001. It's 9/11/2001. But you know, we were just beginning our first semester of Imperial College, it was called at that time, but it's now Herbert W. Armstrong College. So I was assigned to teach Old Testament survey, which I had never, ever done in my life. And so, you know, I had done, you know, a massive amount of study to be able to begin to, you know, take the Old Testament and work it into lectures. And I was in my office that morning, and I think it was Mr. Locher called me, and he said, "Hey, turn on your television. You wouldn't believe what's happening." So I turned on my television. There was Katie Couric. I think it must have been NBC. And all you saw was one of the towers smoking. And they said it was just hit by an airplane. And they don't know if the airplane was off track. They don't know if it was a mistake. And as they were showing the film, and it was live coverage, I saw the second airplane hit the other tower. I mean, I saw that live. And I called my wife into the office. You know, my wife was my assistant at that time. And I said, we both saw it together. It was the most shocking thing we've ever seen in our lives. And you could just hear the people screaming, you know. So do you remember where you were?
Actually, I believe my mother and I had gotten to my third grade classroom.
Yeah.
We were just waiting outside. For some reason, we were really early that day, and we happened to see it in the open area outside the classroom. We were watching it with my third grade teacher. I couldn't really even comprehend it back then. I didn't have any idea what was going on because I was only in third grade.
Yeah, well, I really wanted to set you up for that because I knew you were only in about third grade.
Exactly.
Let me just say this about Grant. He was still pretty smart in the third grade, you know. So
I thought I was smarter than I was, too.
Oh, yeah, your mother did, too.
Well, what was it like, though, whenever you saw the one building and everyone's sort of thought it was an accident at that point, right?
Exactly.
So what was it like when you saw the second building hit and you knew it wasn't an accident anymore?
I think that I was devastated. I just could not believe anything like that would ever happen in America. And it's about that time that even Katie Couric was gasping, you know, and you could hear, like, even the people in the newsroom are really upset. So I think it was just really shocking, and it really was gut-wrenching. And there is so much that we can talk about. I think we ought to talk a little bit about some of those facts about 9/11. But in those two towers, it's amazing that on a really good business day, there would have been 50,000 people in that building. And so if you think about it, once everyone began to realize it was a terrorist attack, it made perfect sense that they would go after that building because they could take out a lot of people. And, you know, I've been in New York many times, and I know when I worked for Westinghouse Electric, they would send me in there for training. And it was always great to go in there and visit New York City. I saw a few Broadway plays and, you know, ate off the street. Not, I mean, I didn't eat on the cement, but I ate. I ate from the truck, the truck food. But anyway, the massive crowds were amazing. I mean, it's like, I know that when we got to some of these classes that they would tell of all of us that were not used to being around the big city, they tell us don't look up all the time because people are going to know you're a tourist and you're going to be subject to crime. You know, so people are going to try and rob you and all that. So you have to keep your head down like all the other New Yorkers. But it is a massively populated city. And so as Krauthammer brings out in his essay, there was a lot of planning went into this.
Yeah, I actually never had realized how many of the people who died that day were police officers and firefighters.
Right.
400 of
400,
them.
Yeah.
Out of the around 3,000 who did die. That's just shocking. But in an area like that where it is so highly populated and you do have 50,000 people trying to get out of the building, it is almost surprising that not more people died in a way.
Right, it is. And the thing is, also, I think that number also includes like Flight 93 and what happened at the Pentagon. But the thing is, it wasn't readily apparent, and they didn't film it, but a few days later we found out that there were people had gone up to the higher levels of the building, and they knew the building was on horrible fire, and to escape the fire, they knew they were going to die no matter what, and they knew the other building had fallen. They were jumping, and so hundreds of people jumped to their death, and that was even more traumatic. But they didn't film it. You know, I mean, it was filmed, but they never showed the films, and at least not till later. So I mean, it was really a really horrific event, and you know, it's really incredible. And a lot of the firemen were killed when the buildings fell.
Mm-hmm.
They were inside trying to help people escape. Now, I do think it's amazing, and I don't know if they've ever done a program about that, but one of the facts of that day is 18 people were actually rescued alive. So I wonder how they've what they could tell you about that, you know. So they were in the building, but they were rescued alive, but only 18.
Wow. Yeah. So the building, was this after the building fell? They
I
were
think
taken
so.
Out of the rubble?
Yeah, I think they were taken out of the rubble. And then one of the other facts about that, it took 9 months to clean up the rubble.
1.8 million tons of it, it says.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. And that there were 18
months.
People that could somehow be pulled out of that is just unfathomable, really.
Yeah. So we had been used to a little bit of domestic terrorism because of the Murrow Building here in Oklahoma City. And I was actually on my way to Chicago that day, and I saw it. When we took off, I felt an air pressure thing. And we took off just about the same time the bombing happened. But when I got off the plane and then all the televisions were on, it said Oklahoma City and the Murrow Building is gone, you know, and all that. So that was pretty shocking because my whole family was still back here. And actually, my daughter Emily was supposed to have a student field trip into that area, and for some reason it got postponed. But she would have been down there at that time. So you can imagine how devastating that would have been to be in Chicago and find out that your daughter was close to the bombing of the Murrow Building.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of stories about people who, like you said, only survived because they didn't go through with their plans of being in the building or being right next to the building that day. There's memorials, obviously the big one in Oklahoma City itself, but all over the state of just people who died or family members who survived them all over the state. It's something that deeply impacts the whole state. It's a pretty big identifying part of the state.
Right. So you can see where, you know, Krauthammer, I think he would have probably been in D.C. at the time, but D.C. and New York are not that far from each other. So I'm sure he knew people there. And, you know, the thing is, one of the things that I think is shocking, and it probably did help make him angry, is that there were warning signs for years that the World Trade Center could be a target. And, you know, there was a 1993 bombing, and I can remember that. That's, you know, when they bombed the World Trade Center. But only about 16 people were killed then. But Krauthammer is a really smart guy, and he knew, you know, the Taliban, these are some other facts that we know about that time. The Taliban had sunk Afghanistan into poverty, violence, and religious persecution. They were already a safe haven for Al-Qaeda. And the thing is even American intelligence even knew some of the men that became the 9/11 hijackers, and they knew what they were up to. And so you think there would have been more surveillance at the time? I mean, they got how many jets? They took possession of how many? Four, I think.
Well, so things like this always show the importance of law enforcement and intelligence agencies cooperating. Right. But like some of this research you printed out for us shows, there is a delicate balance there. A lot of people don't want their privacy encroached upon just for the sake of possibly, maybe thwarting a terrorist attack. Everyone has to be in on it if they want to stop these things. It usually seems like anytime there's a school shooting, anytime there's domestic terrorism at all, these intelligence agencies know something about it.
Right.
But do you want to have a situation where you are arresting people before they've done anything wrong? How much plotting do they need to do before you can take action against it? There are a lot of questions there, but ideally they would take action, especially when we have the benefit of hindsight and we know what they ended up doing.
Right. Right. I do think there are some other things with this that maybe isn't as obvious. And certainly I don't think everything that we know today would not have been as obvious to Charles Krauthammer at the time. And I think you just have to listen to us as we go through this to give what I'm meaning. But I do think that it's interesting that he goes after Colin Powell right away. And so again, he was really up on his politics, and he was very much aware of Colin Powell. And I do think it's interesting. I'll just read another quote here. It says, Secretary of State Colin Powell's first reaction to the day of infamy was to pledge to bring those responsible to justice. Now, he's very clear. Just a four-word sentence. That is exactly wrong. I mean, but you can say he was right. Franklin Roosevelt did not respond to Pearl Harbor by pledging to bring the commander of Japanese naval aviation to justice. He pledged to bring Japan to its knees. Now, and that's, he can tell he's angry. And that, he's taken on Colin Powell.
That example exposes how silly our response to 9/11 really was. I didn't at all think of it as pathetic as it really was until he made that comparison to Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
It's true. I mean, especially with the Japanese back then, they were almost as suicidal as radical Islamic terrorists are today.
Oh, they were dive bombing into the ships. They were dying. They were happy to die for the emperor.
Right.
Yeah.
So you have to take a threat like that seriously and not think that you can, you know, gently obtain or contain these people or take them in and stop them that way. You do have to absolutely crush them because that's the only thing that they will accept. They will not be defeated if they're still alive.
Right. One thing about Colin Powell that I have to think back to this time period, and he was really an impressive man. I mean, he was, his parents were Jamaican refugees that came to America. I mean, he was, you know, a very famous U.S. general. You know, he was made Joint Chief of Staff under Bush. Of course, he would be the first African American to hold either position. He was Secretary of State in 2001. But the thing is that I got this little fact sheet that says that really he was not, for being a general and all that, he wasn't necessarily a hardliner. You know, he was kind of a moderate, and this is what Krauthammer sees right away. He says, look, We don't need a moderate right now. We need someone that's going to bring this enemy to our knees. We're not going to file lawsuits against them, you know. And so the thing is, I mean, there. If you look at Krauthammer, you could think that this guy, you know, here there he is, completely paralyzed from the neck down. But his mind was really strong, you know. And so he's saying, look, this is what we should do. Let's go bring them to their knees.
Well, all the best generals in history have been hardliners.
Yeah.
I mean, you think of neutral type generals, like maybe what George McClellan under Abraham Lincoln, where he could have pushed forward and completely destroyed and devastated the Southern troops against him. And Abraham Lincoln was so upset that he wrote McClellan a letter and then I guess just never sent it to him. But he was livid about the way that some of his generals just wouldn't take a hard line, a hard stance against the enemy, which really would have ended the Civil War a lot sooner.
Right. But I think a lot of them saw them as their brothers, you know, because they were all at West Point together. I mean, the army, the Southern army had been trained at the same place as the North. But the thing is, I think it's interesting that if you, it, and I got my information from the Britannica, and they said that he really began to lose power and influence in 2001. And so I'm sure that he was affected by the way he approached, you know, the 9/11 thing. But I think, and you can tell me if you agree with this or not, but I do think that essentially, if we go back to 2001, that's really not that long ago. I mean, 19 years seems like a long time. I have a feeling, and this is just my feeling, my thinking after reading this, is that, you know, the political atmosphere we see today, this country is so divided, and you have, everything is bipartisan. It's not, I mean, it's separation. It's not, we're going to do a bipartisan, and we're not going to get together, is I do remember back to that time period, and they were, the media, which obviously still had its left leaning then, just 19 years ago, they were making President Bush like a buffoon all the time. Now, I think today we see it's a lot worse because they're doing the same thing to President Trump. So I'm just wondering how much the Democrat Party or the liberals were saying, we got to be careful now how we handle this. You know, do we really know who the enemy is? You know, and, you know, just like just recently, you know, Mayor de Blasio, he won't let the Hasidic Jews get together in groups. But the Islamic people in New York are going to have this festival, and he's going to provide the food for it. All right. So come on. You know, that's I have a feeling this is what Powell was dealing with at the time. And again, it does show weak will to not stand up against that. And that's why I think President Trump is so great. And again, I'm not saying he doesn't have his weaknesses. You know, I think he could do a lot better with a lot less tweets. But I'm not president, and I'm not going to criticize the man who holds the office of a president. But the thing is, he's not afraid of the left-leaning media. He's not afraid of that. He's going to tell them, hey, I'm going to say what... And he just admitted the other day, there's no way I can please them. No matter what I do, it's not going to be right. So I'm not even going to try. You know, he's just going to keep going on.
Well, it does seem like the left will view you as unsophisticated if you don't sort of take this pleasant, neutral stance against enemies.
You're stupid as far as they're concerned.
Right. They're all about thinking of a million different forms of nuance when it comes to enemies. But when it comes to fellow Americans, conservative Americans, religious ones, well, there's no more nuance there. Those people are as evil as they can possibly get, like President Bush or President Trump. They act now like they would love to have President Bush. They're writing love letters to him on social media. Yet back then, he was a total buffoon who couldn't say a sentence the way that they wanted, so they just absolutely hated him.
It's like Cold War nostalgia all over again. These two essays are so, I mean, they're actually, they're so tied together. I'm going to read another quote. Carl Hemmer goes on to say, this is, again, still page 285, you bring criminals to justice, you rain destruction on combatants. Yeah, that's true. And we're going to talk about, you know, some of the things that have been put in the trumpet over the years that we agree with that. So this is a fundamental distinction that can no longer be avoided. The bombings of September 11, 2001 must mark a turning point. War was long ago declared on us. Until we declare war in return, we will have thousands of more innocent victims. And so I still don't think people listened to what Krauthammer said. It's 19 years now.
Well, what has happened since? We've had a war on terror, which is nonsensical. That's a war against an idea. Like, who is the tangible, real enemy you're actually fighting against?
Right. We're going to answer that.
We've pretty much refused to answer that as a nation this
whole
time.
Right. Right.
That's why we've lost.
Right. And that's exactly what Krauthammer was getting at, is that he's saying we're not willing to face it. We're not willing to really face up to what needs to be done now. Now, he didn't necessarily understand it either, and we'll have to probably, you know, finish this in the next program. But I kind of want to set this up a little bit. I think it's interesting, you know, what he says here. He says, we know, this is at the very bottom of the page, it says, we no longer have to search for a name for the post-Cold War era. Now, he ties this really to that other essay, and it's a great way. He says, it will henceforth be known as the Age of Terrorism. Organized terror has shown what it can do. Execute the single greatest massacre in American history, shut down the greatest power on the globe, and send its leaders into underground shelters. All this without even resorting to chemical, biological, or nuclear weapons of mass destruction. Now, he was so right about that. And it really is the age of terrorism. But we're not winning the war against terrorism.
Well, it is disturbing to think about how much worse it could get. I mean, they carried out the 9/11 attacks with box cutters, and they just took over planes where they were way outnumbered by Americans on those planes. But they just, what if they had bigger bombs, bigger weapons?
Right. And anyway, I do think it's interesting that you know, if we go back, I gave you that thing on the commentary on terrorism, and this is what this David and Sarah says. He says the U.S. mindset irreversibly changed the day. No longer did we perceive a world largely at peace following the end of the Cold War. Instead, evil came and found us. Now, I think it's interesting that he tied what happened at 9/11 to the Cold War era, the post-Cold War era. And I think what he and Krauthammer are saying is we become a bunch of peaceniks. You know, it's like after the Cold War was over, we just thought, well, just, you know, everybody, we're just all peaceful now. We don't have to worry about nuclear weapons. We don't have to worry about weapons of mass destruction. We don't have to worry about enemies. Why, everyone wants peace. And isn't that the climate today?
Well, it's almost like we assumed that our enemy could not get any more insane than a communist.
Yeah.
And now communists are pretty crazy, but they certainly are not suicidal like Islamists, radical Islamists.
Yeah.
That's the difference. And people just don't seem to want to acknowledge that they're going to be like that no matter what we do. It's not our fault that we have oil interests in the Middle East. That's not why they're attacking. They are suicidal regardless of that.
Yes. Well, hold that thought, everyone, because guess what? We're out of time for this program. So next time, Grant and I will continue with September 11th, 2001. Now remember, we are reading selected portions of Charles Krauthammer's book of essays titled Things That Matter. There is still a bit more to come now, so I want you to make sure you buy this book at Amazon.com, or you can find a used copy of the book at abbooks.com. Of course, you can check your local library. But I really want to tell you, you need this book. You need to get it. You need to study it. Now, in about 3 weeks, we're going to end our series titled A Tribute to Charles Krauthammer. For our summer series, I'll begin moving back to classic literature. All the selections for the series have been chosen. So I'll discuss details in the next podcast. Now, please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter @JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.